Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Deep Three episode. Today's guest, Nima Onwuevor, one of my coaches in high school, a dear friend of mine, and one of the best recruiters in college basketball, if you ask me. Him and I have been in touch over the years for many, many international players, and he's done a fabulous job everywhere he's been. Nima, thank you so much for accepting this invitation to be on the podcast. It's an honor for me to learn from you and hear some of your stories and plans for the future.
Vlad, it's an honor to join you, the most appropriately named podcast out there in a long list of podcasts. Deep Three, my man shot that thing from deep with no conscience. And every single time he put it up, we had hands up saying, all right, get back on defense. It was pure as can be.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Yeah, I thought it was pretty fitting, you know. Now, only if I could do like three questions a show, that would be great. But that's a little bit hard, right?
No, I want to spend more time with you, man.
Appreciate that. All right, so Nima, we'll start back from the beginning. To me, you know, you met me when I was what, 16. Just came over to the U.S. You were still in college, I believe, and coaching high school.
Yeah.
That was before you coached me high school. And one thing struck me, your passion for the game, and you're one of the hardest working in the business. These coaches, back then you were coaching high school, college coach, high school coach. To me, you were one of the hardest working coaches that I've met over the time. And you have a lot of passion, high dreams, high goals. So tell me a little bit about your high school experience at Jewish Day, at St. John's, and also at Paul VI.
Yeah, so I'll take it back a step further. When I was at Damascus High School, going to Frederick Community College, really early on, I realized, like, you know, playing is great, but I want a future in this game. I'm limited in my athletic ability. And talent, you know, coming out of the Montgomery County, maybe don't necessarily know that. Montgomery County is the town that I, or the county that I grew up in. And I'm sure a lot of other players maybe have this epiphany at times where you think you're a lot better than you really are. But then you realize, you know, there's still opportunities within the game I love. And I made a conscious decision that I wanted to be involved in this game, for the rest of my life. And from that, it led to coaching my high school summer league team. And then it led to someone noticing me coaching the high school summer league team without me knowing that they noticed me. And so that was a good lesson that for as a player or a coach, you're always being critiqued and evaluated. So that person who ultimately was the athletic director at the Jewish Day School invited me to interview for their head coaching position, not knowing how old I was. I was 18 years old at the time, and I didn't tell them how old I was. And then I got the job, and I walk into the Jewish Day School thinking, okay, I'm gonna run a great program just like my high school coach did. And first things first, we're gonna do great with academics. I didn't know the academic history of the school I was at Jewish Day, which is a school that traditionally sends kids to Ivy League schools and high level academics. I hand out a progress report and say, I expect everybody's grades to be turned in by tomorrow. And teachers are calling me saying, what are you doing? Like, all your kids have got good grades. They all got A's and B's. No one on the team had a C. I was like, wow, okay, this is pretty interesting. So it was a learning experience from there. You have to know the types of kids that you're coaching wherever you may be. And it's different at every institution. But it also allowed me to understand pretty quickly, I could push these guys in a different way than they're used to being pushed because they're so cerebral and smart. So we really challenged them mentally. You know, we had a lot of plays. And we won the PVAC championship in my first season. You know, the following season before I came and met up or linked up with you, Vlad, at St. John's, we went to the championship game and lost in overtime on a buzzer shot. It was two really exciting, fun seasons of basketball where, and I'm still in touch with all those kids. Well, they're men now, but all those guys to this day, they accepted every challenge presented to them. And because of who they were, we were able to build and build and build upon them, not just as, you know, basketball players, but with skill sets that were verbal beyond the court.
That's awesome. And how did you transfer from there to the WCAC? For those that don't know, that's my podcast. WCAC to me is still the best league in high school. I think high school basketball is a lot different, but as far as the conference, you know, top to bottom, you're talking about amazing coaches, you know, not just now, but in the past 30, 40, 50 years. You're talking about great programs that produce for college basketball, you know, just like incredible number of players. I can remember DeMatha having like 12 D1 players, and some of their JV team had D1 players already offered as sophomores. So, you know, how's this, and then going to the WCAC where, you know, the level of athleticism, you know, the height. To me, one thing I noticed across basketball everywhere in the world, the higher you go up in level, it's usually athleticism, size that goes skill sometimes doesn't always go higher up, like in level.
Correct.
You know, between like a low D1 and high D1 school, whatever it is. But to me, one thing I noticed was, you know, your small four wasn't, you know, 6'4 anymore, it was 6'7 and stuff like that. But how did you make that transition? How did you see the game going from, you know, Jewish Day to WCAC?
Yeah, I learned a lot from you guys as players. You know, your teammate, Chris Wright, was one of the hardest cutting and hardest guys to guard that I'd ever coached at the time that I coached him. I've coached 14 NBA players, him being one of them. He was able to play with the Mavs. But at the time that I coached him, no one went harder on every possession than him. You presented a whole nother element for teams because you're the most skilled player with size that I ever had a chance to coach. I don't know if you remember this, there's 10 teams in the Washington Catholic League. The 10th place team that year was Archbishop Carroll, who had two NBA players, Rodney Magruder, who I believe is now playing with the Pistons, right? He just left from the Clippers to the Pistons. Shout out Motown Hoops podcast. And then Chris Joseph, who went to where did he go? Syracuse, Georgetown? I can't even remember anymore.
He went to Syracuse and played
Celtics, right?
Yeah.
It's two NBA players on the last place team. The 9th place team had Mike Williams, who went to Kentucky, and Shane Walker went to Maryland. So we, this was, first of all, it's a trial by fire. So you go from Jewish day school, which admittedly is not high level. Our best player ever was a kid that I coached, Eitan Chemerinsky, who went to Cornell. Good player, but he's not playing in the NBA. And so you quickly make a realization that X's and O's are great, but players make plays work. And you can't just fool a player because, as you said, all of a sudden you got a 6'7 small forward. You might set a screen and get a guy open, but that guy's going to close the gap a little bit. So now you got to adjust and alter. The higher the level I've risen as a coach, and I think, Vlad, what you just said is spot on about how players rise to higher levels. But as a coach, the higher the level I've risen, the margin changes in terms of, as a coach, how we can try to coach and execute a play and what may or may not work. And that's why I've always focused on, you know, if I want to be one of the best coaches, I have to have some of the best players. And that's part of coaching and identifying the right types of talent. And because of my experience in the WCAC, where I recruited middle school players to come to St. John's or Paul VI, where I ultimately was, like you mentioned, DeMatha having star players on their bench. Get this, they've had a number one and a number two overall pick play JV at DeMatha, Markelle Fultz and Victor Oladipo. So when you see those type of players in their youth, as 8th graders, 6th graders, 7th graders, 8th graders, 9th graders, 10th graders, you could start to identify over time, ooh, this player here, he could be like that guy. And he can have a chance to make those type of jumps. You see those similar skill sets and talents. I recruited Quinn Cook out of middle school. And I thought Quinn Cook was unbelievably special. But at that time, I didn't know how special he could be. I now know, based on the intangibles that he's got in his arsenal, beyond just being a good player, but there's some intangibles of being a highly coachable young man, being a hard playing young man, an astute mind of the game. That's what leads him to have, you know, world championship rings on the NBA level. He's won a championship everywhere he's been, from CYO to high school to college to NBA, now multiple programs. So that's what the WCAC has really taught me and has given me a leg up as a college recruiter, is I can be a little bit ahead of everyone else because I understand how certain skill sets within middle school translate to success even in college and beyond.
That's amazing. That's honestly, that's really amazing, because a lot of people, I think, they don't understand that, you know, because unfortunately we do live in a highlight culture. And I think coaches, I think players, parents, we all get caught up with that. And, you know, the stuff that you mentioned, the intangibles, those kind of get, overseen sometimes by coaches. And I think that's why we see so many changes in the NBA, in Europe, everywhere, because, you know, we're looking for, you know, the play that's going to win the game or whatever. You know, you're looking for the buzzer beater every time, basically. And to me, I don't know, it's not how it works. So I guess you already gave us some of the insight of why, to me, you're one of the best recruiters in college basketball. So can you tell me how the time at NC State and Maryland helped you? You worked for two amazing coaches. And how did that shape shape you? Not because clearly the WCC set some you know, found it, like a foundation for it, but how the next steps, you know, going to NC State and, you know, in the ACC, from WCC to ACC, right? I think it was it was the best conference college basketball then, and then going to Maryland, which you're alumni of, sure, special on many reasons. So at those two schools, really, how those two coaches, you know, shape you and help you, groom you into the coach you are today?
Yeah, a lot. So prior to going to NC State, I was coaching at Bowie State, and I recruited in, you know, seven players that were able to then go on and win a championship in Division II in the CIAA. But, you know, in Division II, you're often recruiting against nobody. You're finding a guy that maybe others don't know about. When you go into a level like at NC State, that's not happening. You're recruiting against others, and it's the task is presenting a package and presenting an option that checks off as many boxes as that family is looking for. And every family obviously is different. Both of those institutions are amazing places, and they offer different things that would maybe appeal to a family. At both institutions, I believe I was involved with the highest rated recruiting class at the school's history. I've actually been able to have that distinction at every school I've been at, including South Alabama and Bowie State. But, you know, at NC State, we were competing against Duke, Carolina, Kentucky, and Kansas. Okay. Those four blue guys, they rarely lose in recruiting battles. And we lost a couple to them. Now, we also won a couple of them. We signed TJ Warren, first player to ever commit to NC State that had an offer from North Carolina since the 70s. Okay. Now, his dad went to NC State, and it still was a dogfight all the way to the end. And Kentucky was involved as well. And his jersey is now in the rafters at NC State. Loved coaching him. And obviously TJ's doing his thing now in the NBA. But that wasn't easy. There had to be a very strategic plan. And what Mark Gottfried was great at teaching us as a staff was, what is our plan? He's a CEO in the sense that he understands how to run an organization. And we were all unified in our approach on how to recruit for that institution. And everybody's roles were different. So in that time, my role was very intrinsic in terms of what we do on campus once a player arrives, and then what kind of recruiting material we send to them to help capture their attention. Some schools have to recruit a wide range of numbers to get down to their 13 scholarship players. We never even had 13 scholarship players at NC State. We had a very targeted approach, say we're going to recruit the guys that we feel are going to fit best in our program. We're going to stick with them. There's guys at the end of the bench are going to be upset anyway. And so we would have a very calculated approach. So year by year, and I was there for 3 years. Okay. And each season we signed anywhere between, 3 to 5 players, and each player's recruitment was different. I believe at that time we only missed out on 4 players, and of the 4 that we missed out, 1 went to each of those blue schools that I mentioned. So that's pretty good. And so it was a very deliberate, targeted approach of saying, okay, this is what we need to, the information that we need to put in front of this family versus a different family, and how that's going to resonate to them. So that taught me having a very specific plan of action when it goes to recruiting, and then amongst all programs I've been at, relationship building has been paramount. Not being the guy that just calls when you need something, but calls, just to check in or to help somebody through whatever mechanisms we can within basketball, whether it be helping someone get an invite to a camp, helping them get an invite to an AAU tournament, because I used to be an AAU tournament director and I know all the directors, things of that nature. Those are small favors that have zero monetary value, but it shows that you're willing to help, shows that you're willing to care, and it shows that you'll go the extra mile for somebody to help them accomplish whatever they want to accomplish. And then conversely, when they have a player that maybe will come to your program, you're going to do the same thing to help them get noticed. A lot of the guys I mentioned, I've coached 14 NBA players. Not all of those guys were NBA radar guys. Okay. And then, so like to shift to Maryland, which our recruiting in Maryland was elite, still is. They're doing a great job. We really utilized the players that were going to the NBA as part of our message. The other piece of our message there, because it was a little different than at NC State, was the fact that we've got a major media market between Baltimore and DC. If you combine the two, it's third overall. Really, I'm not in Maryland, so I can say it. One's 27th and one's 30th, but because they're so close, you combine them, it becomes that big, but that means something. But then if you utilize it the right way and you get articles out to Baltimore and DC reporters, someone like Jake Layman, who was the 70th rated player in high school, can become a second round pick. Or Kevin Herter, who was a, he was a known player, but not in the sense that he was a top 50 or top, 25 player, but he was, I think, the 19th pick in the draft. So you're able to elevate by getting the information to the right people that will ensure that information gets to the right people. Let me add this one other anecdote, Vlad. I know it's not necessarily recruiting. We were on the bubble at NC State 3 years. Okay, we went 3 for 3. All three, we were on the bubble. At Maryland, we went to the NCAA tournament 3 times. 2 of those times we were on the bubble. The other time we were firmly in. I learned through Coach Gottfried while we were promoting our team, and I learned so much about marketing and promoting your program. It plays a hand in recruiting, plays a hand in guys getting to the NBA. The selection committee are human beings. They have cell phones. They have email addresses. They have offices. You can send information through 3 different mediums. to make sure that they see the criteria that you believe gives you the best chance to make it to the NCAA tournament. And it's the same type of rationale, which we did that everywhere I've been. I've always made a point to send something via FedEx, send an email, make a text message graphic and send it to the selection committee. Say, hey, don't forget about us and here's why. And then when they get to the to about Selection Sunday, those members are quarantined, you know, not in the sense that we think of with COVID, but they're bubbled and they do not have access to outside communication. All they have access to is TV. So what do? You then take that information and you get it to announcers, reporters, people that will then repeat the information that you give them if they deem it to be worthy information. So you make sure you get your ducks in a row, and that's going to be a way to get your team into the NCAA tournament versus not being in the NIT on the wrong side of the bubble. That's something that I've prided myself on, is always figuring out, okay, what's the right information that we need to send to a family, that we need to send to the NBA teams, that we need to send to a selection committee to accomplish the goal that we want to accomplish. Let's make sure we do our job on the court, but let's make sure we tell our story off the court in the right way that the right people notice it.
That's amazing. For whoever thought that college basketball is a lot of X's and O's, sometimes it just seems like that's the smallest part of it, you know, when you get the business of it. And I mean, that explains a lot. I think your success, you just explained your success. I don't know if that's what you meant to do, but it's amazing to me. And, you know, I want to talk about also South Alabama. Okay, it's not the... the ACC, but I thought you did a fabulous job there. I remember, you know, just following your social media, when you had the guys in the gym, you know, counting their shots, and you posted that stuff. And I thought it was cool because it made it competitive. You know, sometimes guys these days, they don't seem competitive, or they don't seem to get competitive until the word gets out there. I think that's a problem. But again, that says a lot about your coaching style and the South Alabama coaching staff, that you have to know and understand how to get those players to, you know, in that competitive zone and in that, okay, like I'm getting better right now. Because unfortunately, I think the Larry Bird days, the magic where you work with the lights off, where, you know, all that stuff that's like far away, you know, you want to be far away, you know, just like you're built in the gym. Now it's like, okay, like I do, you know, if my coach is going to post a board about shooting, I want to be at the top of it, you know, like, and that showed. I remember like a few days ago, we actually retweeted about South Alabama and how great they shot the ball, I think, in their first game this season or
yeah.
So I know you're proud of it. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, going to South Alabama, your expectations? You've been, you know, at this other programs before, and then how you managed to also be successful there in recruiting and coaching.
Yeah. So at South Alabama, Richie Riley, and he did this at Nicholls State as well. And he did this at Clemson as an assistant. He did what he calls morning shooting. Simple as it is. Guys get in the gym, 25 minutes max, normally 20 minutes, but you shoot, catch and shoot threes, no, nothing fancy, nothing crazy. Do it against the clock, something that we can measure. We have consistent passers, consistent rebounders, so everybody's getting the same type of reps, and we track what you do. And every player has got a different set of motivations, okay? Some guys are internally motivated, some guys are externally motivated. I've been in programs where they've said, you know, it's got to be this way or not the other way. We don't make that decision. That decision is made in the 16, 17, 18 years of their development as a human being before they get to us. But what we as coaches should be able to do is identify what motivates each player and play to that. I'll give an example about TJ Warren again. We played against Pittsburgh at the time. Pittsburgh had only ever lost 19 games at the Peterson Event Center. Okay. Again, we're a bubble team. Pittsburgh was hot. This is when Jamie Dixon was still there. Well, TJ is a externally motivated person. Okay. Now internally, his motivation is second to none, but you can add to it. Well, we're playing on the road in a place that we no one ever wins, and we need TJ to step up and be the man. Well, you can add to it. So I created a fake Twitter account, and I tweeted at TJ from one of the other players, one of their star players, Lamont Peterson, said, you know, I'm gonna shut this guy down, I'm gonna bust his ass, blah, 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 blah. And I made sure TJ sees it. TJ's a quiet guy, very cerebral. He just kind of nods his head and goes out and scores 42 points. We didn't have to run any plays. We just gave him the ball and we won the game. And we made it to the NCAA tournament. And we won a game in the tournament. And so that all came about because we understood TJ. Okay. Same thing at South Alabama. Now, you can't play for Richie Riley if you're not competitive. And so he wants guys and he identifies guys that compete. And so naturally, if you tweet or put on social media who's got the highest score from morning shooting, guys are going to compete a little bit harder in those drills, and thus they're going to be just a little bit better when you get to game day. And case in point, and you referenced the tweet that I had the other day, Michael Flowers, who is a transfer there, who's really gone through a whole lot. I've never had the opportunity to speak to him or coach him, but from afar, I see he's going through a whole lot. He's lost both of his parents. He, on that day, 24 hours prior, his father tragically passed, and he made a game-winning three because he's been not just in that gym and not just from that spot, but he's been in a situation that, albeit may not be as pressure-packed, but it just becomes an unconscious moment. And he's prepared for that moment because of the type of repetitions he took and the attention to those repetitions. That's so important. Guys can come in the gym and just shoot casually. What is that really doing for us? But if we put a time on it, give it a task and say, okay, now let's go out and accomplish it, then that much better is going to be our results. And so I think that's part of being, you know, new age. It's 2020. There's coaches that coached alongside me from, you know, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s. Guess what? Things change. And if you're not willing to pivot and adapt, then you're not going to be able to change with the times. Unfortunately, players now are very motivated by the attention that they receive via social media, via the internet, etc. You'll see it every single game. A team loses, but if there's a good play that they had, they retweet it, they've shared on their Instagram story, etc. You know, I hate that, but that's what it is. So you have to understand that, and you have to know that, okay, if this is what motivates players, instead of trying to move the mountain and change that, how can we take the harness the power of the river coming through the mountain and allow that water to cut through the rock? That's something that I've always about and want to continue to do as a coach. We'll do this interview in 10 years from now, Vlad, and it'll be something totally different. We don't know what it might be, but if you're not adaptable, then your team will be the one getting a 3-point shot made against you.
That's you mentioned a few things that I'm huge on, and about the mental side, and you're recognizing, you know, the external factor versus the internal factor that says a lot. To me, one of my best coaches ever was Sasha Filipovski, and I had him in Poland. He's currently in Partizan in Serbia. And I think everybody knows Partizan, you know, a European powerhouse. And to me, not just he was a tough coach, he was great as X and O's, amazing. He made you understand everything. You knew where you had to be with your eyes closed, you know, wake me out of bed. I knew my defensive rotation. I knew everything, just the way we worked on it. But to me, he just knew how to get the best out of every single player. You know, we had an American point guard who's absolutely amazing. He's one of my good friends, debossed. And in the beginning, these are natural scorer. You know, he's in Monaco right now. He's doing amazing. But he was a little bit, for the way we were playing, he was a little bit trigger happy in the first half. He wanted to score. He wanted to score fast. And we were a little bit more of a slow paced team, and we kind of moved the ball around. And he kind of wanted everybody to score about 7, 8, 10 points. That's just how he played. So it took him maybe 1-2 months. But then once Dean understood that, okay, I have to wait my turn, because the fourth quarter, you know, and that's when my time to shine is, you know, to close games, to be that guy in the fourth quarter. And again, he had to know how to motivate me, how to motivate some of the Polish guys, the other foreigners, and also how to motivate D, you know, who's coming from Turkey and who's having a fabulous season, and D ended up being the MVP of the finals. And that's the same thing, you know, just, you have to know how to motivate the players. That's that, to me, that's one of the top three keys into coaching. Because sometimes X's and O's, you know, I don't know, to be honest with you, how many times you can draw a play and, okay, we're scoring off this one. Like, okay, I'm drawing this and we're going to get a stop. If those guys are really going to play hard for you, I think, that's the best thing a coach can do. If those high, you know, if the guys they put on the floor, they're going to give their hearts out for the coach and really feel that connection with the coach. And I think that's what you guys built everywhere you went, and everywhere you, every coach you work for, you guys seem to build that, you know, the trust and connection between the players and the coach. And, you know, that says a lot. And I want to ask you about this, about the mindset of coaches, you know, and you, I know you touched on this, how coaches are different now, and you seem to have a great mentality on that, where you adapt at times, whether you like it or not. I always have a hard time posting highlights too after like a loss or something. I try to stay away from that as much as possible. Hopefully I've never done it, but I'm not gonna put my head in the fire. So how do you adapt to all this? Because when you started coaching, right, we were, I don't know, at St. John's for like 06, 07, I slowly moved up the ladder. And you really started, what amazing about your story is, like you said, you know, you started as a player, you realized that it wasn't really the thing that you could have excelled in. So you chose this path, and you chose from the bottom. And I think you've done an amazing job, and that says a lot about your work ethic too. So can you tell me about the mindset of coaches? How has your mindset changed over time? In regards of how you see players or how you coach players?
Yeah, so my mindset, first of all, is built and shaped because I've been able to, fortunately, I've been able to have every role in a basketball program, from head coach, assistant coach, director of operations, video coordinator, graduate assistant. I've done all of those roles, and I've excelled at all those roles. And as a result, I've been tasked with doing all different types of tasks. So I understand they're all important. I understand, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And with a lot of success also, sometimes preceding that is failure. And so having some trial and error has been a great educator for me. I think too, when we coached at St. John's, or when I coached at St. John's, your teammate, Mihai Pecu, who was a really talented player, but we couldn't get anyone to come and really identify that. Why? Because, well, you had the ball, Chris Wright had the ball. So he was a third or fourth option on a team, which, like I said, had a league full of NBA players on the last place team. Now, we finished second place that year behind DeMatha, unfortunately, who had, as you said, 12, 13 Division I players. So how do we get his name out there? We got to get some guys to practice as opposed to the games. How do we do that? It's cultivating relationships. You know, Coach Zimmerman, who's at Barton College, where he ultimately went, he and I cultivated a relationship while at camp. So from there, it was peer-to-peer, one-to-one. Go to Paul VI, where we're at a program that had no historic success. So when you call somebody from one-to-one and say, and they don't know who I am, and I say, hey, come to St. John's College High School in DC. Coaches say, ooh, I've heard of them. Number two in the WCAC, top 25 in the country. I think at one point we were top 10 in the country. Sure, we'll come see him. Now you go to Paul the Sixth and it's like, who are you? We've never heard of Paul the Sixth. So now you start marketing to more people. And so now I started doing email marketing and say, okay, if I'm going to email 5,000 coaches, D1, D2, D3, I got a chance to take that same conversation and do it 5,000 times. This was early on in email marketing. And now all of a sudden we've got kids, same level, Division II, low Division I, getting looks and getting scholarships. I think of a kid we had there, Ron Burks, who had no recruitment going into the same time as Mihai, ended up going to VMI, ended up being a freshman, ended up beating Kentucky in his first ever game. He just needed the right opportunity. He just needed to be put in the right light to be seen. So my mindset has always been, okay, at every place, you can't just do it the way you did it the other place. You've got to really identify who you are as a school and how you can get your name out there. Now, my name is Nima. There's only one as far as Nima in coaching. And as I've been able to climb the ladder and have success, my name is more readily recognized. Even if people don't know me, they feel like they know me. So it's become easier. So it's kind of come back the other way. Now I can go a little bit more one-to-one, peer-to-peer. So if I call a AAU coach, and now the roles are reversed, as opposed to me promoting the high school kid, I'm promoting our university and trying to get a high school kid. It could be done in a multitude of ways. When you're at NC State, when you're at Maryland, you don't need to blanket the world with all that information because you're recruiting a smaller pool and everyone will be impressed with that information because of the level. And so that's great. But now you get to a place where people maybe don't want to pay attention or maybe they're not rushing to pay attention to your institution, like at South Alabama, which at one point we were top 25 recruiting class. At George Washington, where we were 21st ranked recruiting class. It's because of the information we've disseminated on a mass market, if you will, Twitter, Instagram, and creating that branding plan that by the time you get to that phone call with the young man and their family, they've heard something about you and they understand that information a little bit better. And thus it's gonna be a little bit easier to tell the story. That's been my approach and how it goes. And it will constantly change. It will constantly change. And I'm comfortable with that change. You just have to be able to tell the same story through a different medium or through a different mechanism.
That's awesome. That's a great piece right there because, like you said, if you're going to be willing to keep changing, keep adapting, you're always going to be at the top of the game, if you ask me. Now, Nima, I know you just started a podcasting game. You have a new podcast called Through the Channel. It's part of Rising Coaches platform. I've followed a few podcasts of theirs on that platform. I think they do a really, really nice job. So can you tell me what Through the Tunnel is? You know, what the podcast is about and also where people can find it.
Yeah. So first of all, you can find Through the Tunnel and we spell it THRU, like a drive through. So it could fit on Twitter. So it wasn't too long, but you can find Through the Tunnel on Apple Podcasts or Spotify Podcasts. You could also watch it online if you're a Rising Coaches member. Based off of kind of what we've talked about today, I found it very interesting in recruiting different pockets around the country and around the world. And how there's some commonalities, but a lot of differences. And over time, and you know, I've been fortunate now to be a coach for 16 years. When I coached you, Vlad, I had a lot more hair, man. So did you, by the way. It's been that long. We both lost all of our hair. But you really start to realize those type of trends. And it's different to recruit West Coast kids and families in East Coast and Midwest and South and overseas. And so each one of our episodes spends time, you know, we talk about an hour with 3 to 4 experts on that area. So we've, you know, so far released episodes on Baltimore, Virginia, Ontario, Atlanta. You know, we're going to all the different hotbeds, Houston, Texas. We'll go into Iowa. We'll go to the Pacific Northwest. We'll go overseas to Scandinavian countries. We'll go overseas to the Balkans. We'll spend time talking to coaches in China and spend time talking to coaches in Japan. And so listeners will be able to, you know, find out, you know, some of these commonalities and some of these differences. And, you know, to be honest, it translates beyond sports because each region and each area has got something different to talk about and other pressing concerns on the forefront of their mind. When you talk to coaches from New Orleans, like we do in our episode that's going to be released next week, you hear coaches talking about the importance of keeping them in the gym to stay away from violence, keeping them in the gym to keep them, you know, off the streets from external problems. That is a motivator for kids in New Orleans. And it's important to know that as a recruiter. Whereas, you know, there's equal intensity and importance in other cities, but it's for a different reason. And so I've always been fascinated by that. There's great players everywhere, all around the world. You're a testament to that, Vlad, that, you know, as a high school program, we were able to identify you. And at the time when you were here in high school, you were one of the most recruited players in the country. The coaches that came through every single day to see you and recruit you was astounding. If you were in Romania, not in Washington, D.C., your recruitment would have been very, very different. You may or may not even have made it to college. And so just because we put on a different uniform and you're now in Washington, D.C., all of a sudden you get offers from Kentucky, Wake Forest, NC State. The list goes on and on and on. So my task in this project is, you know, there are players in areas around this country, and I've seen them with my own eyes. And that's why I really enjoy evaluating and recruiting players from all different parts of the world and say, damn, if this kid was in the WCAC, which we identified as being the best basketball conference where they got NBA players on the last place team, man, this guy would be a top 25, top 100 player. But instead, he's in the middle of nowhere, Alabama, and no one knows he exists except for the local community college. That's fascinating. And I've seen that over and over again. And for me, it's always fun to help bring those opportunities to those players. That's why I got into coaching. I love basketball, but the addiction that ensued from coaching is from helping players, from allowing them to achieve their goals and dreams. And there's nothing better than when a player says the two most magical words, thank you. So, you know, we're just trying to raise awareness for different areas. And, you know, right now through COVID, it's no recruiting. It's a dead period all the way till after the Final Four. And so if there's going to be kids to earn those opportunities, the playing field is leveled right now. It's not going to be more people going into a gym because they're in a busy city or whatever. It's a matter of what kind of connection can you make with the right coaches in the right cities. And do you trust your eyes enough to recruit that player? That's what it comes down to. And I think that's the most exciting part about recruiting is that process of the evaluation, understanding the family, understanding the landscape of where they're from, what motivates them, all the things that we talked about today that goes into ultimately winning a championship.
Great info right there. Thank you so much for joining us, Nima. And unfortunately, we had some connection issues at the end of podcast, and we could not say goodbye properly. But again, thank you so much, Nima, for joining us. Thank you, everyone that listened to this podcast. And I look forward to catching you on the next one.